Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. The major championship season for 2023 is in the books. A mix of top names, expected winners, and some very unexpected winners, made for compelling play and stories. In the men's, John Rahm, he displayed ball-striking brilliance to win his first green jacket and his second major title. Brooks Koepka won one for the LIV Golfers, the PGA Championship, which was his fifth major victory. Wyndham Clark drove and putt his way at the LA Country Club to the top of the leaderboard at the U.S. Open, earning his first major title. Very exciting. And Brian Harman did the same. He put on a putting clinic at Royal Liverpool to win his first major title, the Open Championship. In the women's, American Lilia Vu won two major titles in the season. The 25-year-old won the Women's Open Championship by 6 shots, and the first major of the season, the Chevron Championship, in the first playoff hole. Allison Corpuz of Hawaii won her first major title at the U.S. Open at infamous Pebble Beach. Celine Boutier won the Evian Championship in her home country by 6 shots. China's Ronnie Yin made a clutch birdie putt on the 72nd hole to win the KPMG Women's PGA Championship at Baltusrol. The senior men, 50 and over, they had an exciting season as well. And Steve Stricker, he dominated. He won 3 of the 5 majors for the seniors in 2023. Stricker won the Region's Tradition at Greystone Golf and Country Club in Birmingham, Alabama. He won the KitchenAid Senior PGA Championship in a playoff over Padre Carrington at Fields Ranch East in Frisco, Texas, and the Colleague Companies Championship at Firestone Country Club in Akron, Ohio. Bernard Langer, wow, what a story. What a legend. He took the U.S. Senior Open at Century World in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, breaking Hale Irwin's record to earn his 46th senior tournament and his 12th senior major title. And Alex Cheka, he defeated Padre Carrington at the second playoff hole to win the Senior Open Championship at Royal Porthcawl Golf Club in Wales. Well, there's always a lot going on in golf. And first of all, how about some instruction this morning? If you are a tennis player or perhaps played football or baseball or other sports and are finally ready to try golf. Well, you know, golf is a sport you can learn anytime. It is a lifelong learning experience for sure. And yes, it is very challenging. But if you get the proper instruction and practice, you can transfer many of your athletic skills to your golf swing. It's important to connect with a PGA instructor that understands your background and goals and who communicates effectively, and you understand that kind of communication and learn the proper technique. Bill McAdon, longtime PGA pro and director of golf at The Rock Golf Club in Wading River, New York. He will join us this morning and share tips on how to transition to golf from other sports without really reinventing the wheel. And 2022 U.S. Senior Women's Champion Jill McGill, love her name, is doing very important work in addition to raising a family and winning golf tournaments. Her sister, also caddies for her, is an ovarian cancer survivor. And Jill connected with the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance and is raising awareness about ovarian cancer, a cancer that is very difficult to diagnose. I think you'll be interested in hearing Jill and her sister's story and all the work they're doing for ovarian cancer research. And 6-time major champion Phil Mickelson has been the lead in the LIV Golf movement since he joined this circuit, funded by the Saudi Public Investment Fund back in 2022. Well, there's a book written by high-stakes gambler Billy Walters who served a 5-year sentence for insider trading. And he has put Mickelson back in the spotlight, this time for Mickelson's gambling issues. While in prison, Billy Walters wrote a book called Gambler: Secrets from a Life at Risk. And he describes the extent of Phil Mickelson's gambling addiction. I'll share what I read in an excerpt that initially came out in Fire Pit Collective and was reprinted by Golf Digest. Walters wrote in his book that he met Phil at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am back in 2006, and then he ran into Phil again at another PGA Tour event in 2008. And Phil asked him about doing a gambling partnership. Walters told him he does not do partnerships, in quotes, but only if someone has access to places they can't bet or places where they can bet more money than me, end quote. So they entered into a gambling partnership that lasted 5 years. In 2012, Walters wrote in the book that Phil called him from Medina Country Club outside of Chicago, where the Ryder Cup matches were taking place. And Walters said that Phil was so confident that the U.S. team would win, he asked Walters to place a $400,000 wager for him on the U.S. team to win. Billy Walters told him in quotes, "Have you lost your freaking mind? Don't you remember what happened to Pete Rose?" Billy told Phil in quotes, "You're seen as a modern-day Arnold Palmer. You'd risk all that for this? I want no part of it." End of quote. Phil said, "All right, all right." Billy went on to write that he had no idea if Phil actually placed the bet anywhere else. But I tell you, those are serious allegations. You have to think the powers to be that run the Ryder Cup and all of golf would have to do some investigative work to see if Phil really did bet on his own team in the Ryder Cup. In a statement released after these transcripts from the book came out, Phil Mickelson denied that he bet on the Ryder Cup. He said he did not make that bet, nor did he gamble on his own golf. He said in quotes, "I never bet on the Ryder Cup. While it is well known that I always enjoy a friendly wager on the course, I would never undermine the integrity of the game. I have gotten very open about my gambling addiction," he said in quote. He wanted to say that he had taken responsibility, has gotten help, has been fully committed to therapy that has positively impacted him, and he feels good about where he is now, end of quote. Well, Billy Walters went on to write about Phil's gambling addiction, including betting $110,000 to win $100,000, a total of 1,115 times. Billy Walters wrote, in 2011 alone, Phil Mickelson made 3,154 bets, an average of nearly 9 bets a day. He made a staggering 7,065 wagers on football, basketball, and baseball. He said he calculated Phil's gambling losses to be closer to $100 million, not the $40 million reported, and that he bet as much as $1 billion over the last 30 years. Billy Walters then wrote that Phil, in quotes, is one of the most famous people in the world and a man I once considered a friend, refused to tell a simple truth that he shared with the FBI and could have kept me out of prison. I never told him I had inside information about stocks, and he knows it. All Phil had to do was publicly say it. He refused. End of quote. Well, I will share an interview I did with Mark Canizero of the New York Post, who defends Phil Mickelson in this latest firestorm. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Sports Interview with Ann LaGorry. My guest is Bill McAdon, director of golf, The Rock, in Wading River, New York. Bill is from a family of PGA professionals. His dad was a PGA pro in Massachusetts. Bill worked at Oak Hill Country Club in Rochester, New York under Craig Harmon. And after several teaching positions in Connecticut, he spent 16 years at Port Jefferson Golf Club and then moved further east to The Rock in Wading River. Welcome to Talking Golf, Bill.
Good morning, Ann. How are you this morning?
Good, good. You know, we haven't really focused much on swing instruction on this show this season, so I thought it may be helpful to have an instructor on. And I know, Bill, your teaching philosophy is really more about developing a swing that works for the individual and really not redesigning a swing, right?
Yeah, well, the most important thing that you can focus on is trying to develop your best swing. So each individual is going to have either some physical limitations or some, you know, ailments in their body, so they're not going to be able to produce the swing that they want to. So what we try to do is we try to produce a swing that kind of resembles something that they did in a previous sport when they were younger.
Right, and well, before you even do that, it's probably important, I think, when selecting an instructor to connect with somebody who kind of takes the time to watch your swing and who actually takes the time to really get to know your athletic background a bit, maybe ask, you know, the student some questions. So, I mean, what would be some of the questions you would ask a golfer before you even look at his or her swing?
Well, I think the most important thing that you have to ask them if they have any physical limitations. If they have any physical limitations, you put that information into, you know, your memory bank and kind of just focus on how we're going to get the best possible swing for what they can do with their body type. You know, each body is going to be a different size, different weights, different physical limitations. So what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to focus on getting that person to swing the club as freely as we can to try to get them to bring back some of the sports that they've played when they were younger. So it makes it a lot easier for them to develop their fundamentals.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of players, you know, come to golf in midlife after a lifetime of playing other sports, not golf. I mean, I played a variety of sports. Tennis was my main sport, but, you know, other people come from playing baseball or hockey. And maybe can you go through perhaps those three sports and talk about what athletes should think about in making the transition from other sports to a golf swing?
Yeah, absolutely. So tennis and golf are very similar. You know, they're both going to require, you know, decent forearm strength, you know, good conditioning, you know, mental strength, and, you know, some strategy. You know, they both have very similar postures where you're going to get in that athletic stance like you're getting ready for a serve. It's going to be the identical stance that you're going to want to get to when you're getting ready to hit a golf ball. You know, obviously some of the things that benefit you when you're in tennis, if you have excellent core strength, it's going to help you with your golf swing. You know, I think the thing you can explain to your students when they play tennis, when you're trying to introduce them into golf, is they both have a backswing and they both have a downswing. You know, the hand should be relaxed and move freely, you know, giving the ability to release the club head, giving you the ability to release the racket. Those are going to be some of the things that I talk about with a tennis player. You know, and then when the club and the racket are taken back with the hands and the arms, you try to stay relaxed so you can keep the club and the racket on the right plane. You know, so these are some of the things that they've done when they've played tennis. It gives them the ability to kind of focus on what they're going to do when they play golf. And I think one of the interesting things that you can kind of teach a tennis player when they're getting used to starting to play golf is, you know, some of the tennis shots that they've hit while they play tennis are some of the same swing thoughts that they're going to make when they play golf. So if someone's going to hit a cut shot in tennis, they're going to hit a cut shot in golf. If someone's going to try to hit a draw in tennis, they're going to try to hit a cross-court shot with their forearms. So basically, you can kind of relate those types of similarities when they're playing so that tennis player can kind of feel like they already have that motion in their body, and then they don't have to think too much, and they can just kind of react. Mm-hmm. You know, because less tension is going to equal more speed. More speed is going to get you to hit the golf ball further and straighter. So that would be kind of something that I would talk to a tennis player like yourself. You know, I've seen you swing the club. You have excellent rotation. You know, you hit the ball very aggressively. You know, you create the power with your legs. I mean, very, very important for a tennis player to do that. And if you can explain that to them when they're playing golf, they become a better golfer in a much faster period of time.
So, but in tennis, you know, you're constantly moving your feet. At least I do. And I had to learn how to stay in golf firmly planted on the ground, but you still have to make, you know, that complete turn to finish a golf swing. And I think that was, you know, the most difficult for me without, you know, you have to make that turn, but you can't move your entire body.
Yeah, but you still are rotating your body around. Like in tennis, when you try to hit the shot in tennis, you're facing the net and you're turning and facing the net. And if you can explain to that golfer that's played tennis before that the golf swing is going to be very similar, where you're going to turn and you're going to face your target and you're going to kind of get that body rotating through and try to plant on your left foot and stay stable. So in tennis, you're going to continuously move, but in golf, you're going to try to post up on that left side and really get the weight on that left side so you can create as much power as you can, you know, without falling off balance.
Right, right. What about baseball players? What do they bring to a golf swing? What should they think about?
Well, the similarities in baseball, I mean, both sports you need to load up. You're going to really want to have a solid hip rotation. You know, there's going to be a great shifting of the weight. You know, you really want to focus on, you know, the impact needs to be square, you know, either with a golf club or the baseball bat. You know, the follow-through in baseball is very similar to the follow-through in golf. You know, both have nice fluid motions. And then you want to release the, you know, you want to release the club and the bat just like you do in both sports. So this is easy for a baseball player because the hand and eye coordination is excellent. You know, their upper and lower body strength really helps them to hit the golf ball straight and far. You know, they're both generating power from the ground up, which is really important, especially in both sports. You know, they're going to use their legs and their torso to get the bat or the club to swing faster, which is really important. The main difference is the plane of the club. You know, obviously you're swinging it at 90 degrees, and you're going to be swinging it at 45 with golf. So it makes it a little bit harder for the baseball player compared to the hockey player, but they're used to making solid contact with the ball. You know, I think the question that we always have is what's harder to hit, you know, a 90-mile-an-hour fastball or a golf ball? So for the baseball player, they're finding it much easier to hit the baseball, or the golfer's finding it much easier to drive the golf ball 300 yards down the fairway. So I think the important thing is when you're talking to a baseball player, to try to get some of the similarities that they do in baseball when they're trying to learn how to play golf. The only flaw that sometimes some of the baseball players, especially someone that's played at extremely high level, is they like to hit the golf ball from the right side. So about 25 years ago, they came up with a system called the stack and tilt system, which allows the baseball player that can transition their weight to the left side at the end of the swing, where they hit from the right side and they can still be an exceptional golfer. So you've got a variety of ways to teach a baseball player the same swing, you know, as a golfer. And if they have trouble transitioning weight, then you just use a different system to kind of give them the benefits to hit the golf ball as, you know, the best that they can.
You brought up that age-old question, what's more difficult to do, hit a stationary golf ball or a 90-mile-an-hour fastball? What about for you, Bill? What's more difficult?
Well, for me, would be the fastball, that's for sure.
I remember reading where the great Sam Snead and Ted Williams once debated that question, and, you know, what's more difficult, hitting a stationary golf ball or a 90-mile-an-hour fastball, and Sam Snead told Ted Williams, you don't have to go into the stands and play your foul balls. I do.
Yeah.
But anyway, hockey players, you know, I interview a lot of celebrity golfers who come from hockey, and they seem to be the best golfers. Why is that? Is that same swing, different plane kind of thing?
Well, I think the easiest thing to think about is that hockey has that mental toughness, the hand-eye coordination, the flexibility, the posture. You know, they're going to use the lower body to create width and power like you need to do in golf. They're extremely balanced, and they have that release. And they've been taught since they were a young child to, you know, compress the ice like you need to compress the ground when you're hitting a golf ball. So they've been swinging their hockey stick on the plane, similar to a golf swing, for years. So it's a lot easier for them to understand how important it is to catch the bottom of the golf ball. The difficult part with golf that's a little bit different than other sports is I'm going to ask a player to swing the club anywhere between 50 and 100 miles an hour. I'm going to ask them to be able to hit a penny every single time that they swing the club. And then I'm going to ask them to have that club face perfectly square at that exact point. So that makes it very, very difficult, you know, for a lot of people, because they can get that club to strike the penny, but the club face is either opened or closed. And then the further you hit it, the more difficult it is to square that club face up. So the hockey player has a huge advantage over the other sports because they've been compressing the ground and compressing the ice their entire life when they swing the hockey stick, the same as a golfer. You know, it's much easier for them because it's a natural athletic ability. And they really understand that it's important to get the hands out in front when they get to impact, just like you do in hockey. So that's kind of, you know, very, very similar. I find that the hockey players probably advance the fastest from all the other sports, you know, because it's so similar, you know. And they're used to shooting a puck, you know, as they're moving, you know, where when they get stationary, they find it a little bit easier to do so. You know, and then they have a much easier chance to make solid contact. You know, a slap shot's a very similar move to hitting a golf ball. So, you know, they've been doing this for years, and then just getting them to be able to square the, you know, the club face up at impact gives them the ability to probably improve their fastest.
Right, right. Well, I think, you know, people who aren't as familiar with golf may think that maybe, you know, take a couple lessons to begin, and then there's no more need for instruction. But, you know, the pros are constantly working on their swings. They're every day, they're being watched and analyzed and coached by their swing coaches, and they rely on instruction frequently. So you can never perfect golf. So I guess the point is, you know, you can't get frustrated, and you know, it's really a sport where there's like a lifelong learning curve, right?
Well, I think that the difficult part is that the body changes. So as the body changes, we have to modify the swing for that individual. You know, obviously when we're younger, we're more elastic. We can move a little bit freer, you know, and as we get older, you know, what happens is sometimes the muscles tighten up, or maybe there's a knee surgery or a hip surgery or a back surgery. So we have to modify the swing for that individual so they continue to play at a high level. And, you know, the neat thing is about golf is you can maintain that competitive spirit that you have, you know, well into your 80s. So you can get out there, you can enjoy your friends, but you can still have that competitive edge that you want to have that when you were younger, when you played all the different sports, you know. But I think the important part about taking lessons is having someone else's eyes look at your swing. Because sometimes what you feel and what you're actually doing are two different things. You know, most of the time when I'm giving a lesson, and I ask the individual, where do you think you're aiming? And they'll tell me, well, I think I'm aiming at the pin. And then I'll hold the club for them and ask them to stand behind and look at it. And they go, I didn't realize I was aiming 25 yards right at the target. So what it is I think the coaching part of the teaching aspect is really important, where you give the student fundamentals, you continue to coach them, you train them on the golf course so they can play at a high level. And sometimes it's just getting them to play to have fun, enjoy their family, spend time with loved ones. So I think it's important to try to blend the golf into the competitive side, but then also the enjoyment side and then the family time side. I think it's really important because, you know, we're very fortunate where, you know, we can play the sport until you know, well into our later life. And it's fun to spend time with family. It's fun to spend time with friends. And, you know, I know that I'm going to be playing for a very long time, so there's nothing more enjoyable than getting out with my wife Michelle and my son Jerry and just having a great day, and then also competing against my friends. So, you know, we'll continue to do that. I love that competitive part of it, and, you know, having a coach that can kind of continue to, you know, keep your skills sharp so you can enjoy the game, I think that's very important.
Absolutely. You just mentioned many reasons why golf is just an incredible sport for the whole family. Before I let you go, tell us about your club, The Rock.
Oh, well, the Rock Golf Club, an amazing place. The La Mangino, Vinay, and Vogel family, they're redefining the private club experience. You know, we're creating an atmosphere here where there's no tee times required. You can come out any day, any time, and enjoy this facility. You know, we have really three rules here. You enjoy yourself when you come, you leave the place better than you found it, and you're nice. You know, it's going to be a very special place for a limited few. We're only going to have a membership of about 200. The golf course has unbelievable elevation changes and views that are off the charts. This place is unbelievable. We have probably one of the best wildlife environments that we have out here. You know, we pride ourselves in that. You know, I think that the thing is that we're trying to create something special where, you know, it's your own private club experience. When you come out here, there's no tee times, show up any day, any time. You have some family that's in town. There's going to be five or six of you. You want to play together. We let you play as five or six. If someone pulls up behind you and they're playing a little faster, you just let them play through. You know, we're looking to do something a little bit different than most clubs. You know, it's going to be, we're looking to bring back that special feeling, you know, where it's a world-class golf. You're at your own private club. You're going to have an exceptional dining experience, and it's a place where you can call home. You know, I mean, it's a very special place. Mr. Lamangino and Mr. Vinay have really, really put their hearts and souls into this place. We're about a year and a half into a five-year renovation. We've done a lot of improvements to the facility. We're going to continue to improve the facility, you know, through time. And, you know, the goal here is that, you know, our magic is going to be in the detail. You know, the Rock is going to be a very special place, and we're very proud of it.
Bill, I really appreciate the swing tips. And especially for those who come to golf late in life from other sports, very interesting insight. Thanks so much for being on Talking Golf. Really appreciate
it. Have a great day.
The Women's Open Championship, the final major on the women's calendar, concludes today. In fact, it's going on right now. And joining me now to talk about that and a number of other topics is Jill McGill, reigning U.S. Senior Women's Open Champion.
Thanks, Anne. I appreciate you all having me.
Oh, our pleasure. Well, before we get into golf, I understand that you are using your platform to educate people about ovarian cancer and the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance, OCRA, and their effort to fight the disease. So certainly a most important cause.
It is. You know, I found myself in a position where my sister was diagnosed with ovarian cancer during COVID. And, you know, anytime anybody gets that sort of news, it's obviously going to be a struggle, but coupled with COVID. So I saw the struggles that she went through. And then one of my best friends that I've known, you know, almost all my life, is currently struggling with the fight of cancer. And, you know, it's interesting, Anne, once you put it out there and you start talking to people, how many other people come up and say, oh, I had ovarian cancer, my sister, my aunt, or my friend's friend. And OCRA, Ovarian Cancer Research, has been great. I mean, I just know the tip of the iceberg about the ovarian cancer, just based on the circumstances of having those two people that are super close to me have to go through this. But man, they're doing a lot of great stuff to help a lot of people that have been diagnosed.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned how many people, I lost a cousin to it, and I have a annual charity golf tournament, and we raise money for various not-for-profit organizations, and we have supported the Samuel Waxman Cancer Research Foundation specifically with research on ovarian cancer, because I know it's so hard to detect, and that's one of the issues. It's hard to diagnose, right?
Yes, as I understand it, it is hard to diagnose. For example, my friend Liz, I mean, she got passed back and forth for 4 or 5 months until she found herself in the ER with excruciating pain, draining 7 liters outside of her body down around her abdomen area before they were able to definitively say, you have ovarian cancer. And by that time, it spread all through the body. Mm. So the other thing about Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance is they are very, very strong supporters in early detection, as well as advocates for making sure you're your best advocate for your health. And one thing that I was shocked to learn, is they have the numbers that if you have a genetic marker for cancer, your likelihood of developing it is between 40 and 50%. So imagine if you know you have that marker and you can be super proactive about your health, that how the decline that we would see in terms of cancer cases.
Exactly. So your sister is a survivor, Shelley O'Keefe, right? And she's been your caddy as well, right?
Yes, my sister Shelley, she's awesome. She is a tremendous athlete in her own right. And after playing collegiate soccer and, you know, skiing on the World Cup mogul team, just those two little things, she decided to turn to golf. And so we've really been able to enjoy a relationship on the golf course. And she's a tremendous teacher. She works a lot with juniors. So when she did caddy for me at the U.S. Senior Open last year when we won, she was, you know, just out of chemo treatments and having the surgery to remove her, you know, uterus and omentum tissue as well. So not only was it a great, you know, win, but it was a personal win for her health, being able to be out there all week and physically rise to the challenge that it presents.
Right. So being so close to it, as your sister was dealing with it, and your friend, as you mentioned, what's your advice? What do women have to do to try to, you know, prevent or, you know, early detection, that kind of thing?
Well, I definitely am becoming more and more a believer in the genetic testing and knowing what your makeup is. Some people don't want to know because who wants to know if they have a cancer gene? I don't think anybody wants to know that. However, if you do know that, you certainly can actively seek help. And there's so many resources in terms of what you can do to prevent it. And women's health a lot of times, and this is not a woe is me, I feel like kind of gets put on the back burner, especially as we mature and progress in life. When you start going through perimenopause and menopause, because there's so many overlapping symptoms. So I would say my advice would be go to your doctor. If the doctor is not willing to be patient and answer questions for you, change your doctor and definitely find somebody who is an advocate and who is very well-versed in women's health and is passionate about the station of life that you're in for your health.
Great advice, Jill. Really, really great advice. All right, let's switch over to some of these championships going on right now. There's so much happening at this, you know, always in golf. And the U.S. Women's Amateur is down to the finals. And it has come down to Latona Stone of LSU against Megan Schofield, Auburn University graduate student. And is this, I don't think there's any championship more grueling than these amateur championships, right? Yeah, just to get to the finals, you have to win five different matches. And I know you won the U.S. Women's Am in 93. So what are your thoughts about these grueling events?
You know, I think when you're in the midst of playing it, you don't really give it very much thought. You just, you turn the power on and you go, go, go. And it's one of those things where after the event is finished, you look back and you recognize, whoa, that was a tough week. I played two qualifying rounds, 36 holes, and I think it's two of the rounds. I have to go back and look for sure. But it is a lot of golf over the course of 7 days. Now, you know, I can only say for myself, and I apologize to my opponents that may be on the brunt of this, but you know, luckily I had, you know, one or two matches that didn't go the full 18 holes.
Right.
So when that happens, you get a little bit of a reprieve, which is nice. But it is grueling. It's very physically and mentally taxing.
And they have to play 36 holes today in the final round.
Right.
I mean, it's not just, we got this far. Now we can just play 18. They play 36, so it doesn't stop. Well, are you amazed at how far, you know, the talent has come since your amateur playing days? I mean, the depth of talent now in the women's game, to me, is so impressive.
Oh my goodness. It is amazing. I mean, I give this analogy. I went back to finish my degree and the first night of class, I'm sitting in the front row and I have my notebook and my pen and I look around and everybody has their laptops out. And I went, so this is how it is today. And it was the same thing when I went to play the Open at Pebble Beach this, you know, a couple of weeks ago. I'm on the driving range and I look down and everybody has their Foresight and their TrackMan technology and I'm throwing wind up like, I think it's going to be about 4 or 5 miles an hour. So the ability that they have to really, really hone in on exactly what they're doing with their golf games and then being on the course, I was always considered one of the longer players and, you know, on tour now, granted I'm 51, I would be average off of the tee. I mean, the strength and the ability is really phenomenal and it's quite impressive to watch in person.
Do you credit that to the equipment and technology or their training or maybe a little bit of both?
I think it's all of the above. I mean, I think you can take technology, like I had mentioned, Foresight and TrackMan. And to be able to go onto a driving range and to be able to really, you know, zone in on hitting 30 wedges and having 25 of the 30 hit within 5 or 10 feet. That gives you really good indication of what you want to do on the golf course. The technology is definitely helping with the distance and the consistency. And then really, you know, the event of video that you can have on your iPhone now, the super slow motion frame by frame, so you can go back and look, oh, the face was a little open, or I was doing this with my hips or my shoulders, whatever each player is working on, is such a valuable tool. I mean, not only in golf, just in sports in general. So all three of those factors really, if implemented, and the sky's the limit for the talent of the women's golf.
Absolutely. And they're starting younger and focusing in on golf at an earlier age, I feel. But all right, quickly, the Women's Open going on right now. Charlie Hall of England, Lilia Vu of the United States, they share the lead at 9-under. They have a one-shot lead. Allie Ewing, she held the lead after 18 and 36 holes, but she shot a +3 yesterday. But she's only 2 shots back, so anything can happen. Have you been watching the women at the Open?
You know, I wish I could say that I have been watching the women at the Open, but I was on pickup camp duty for my own kids. So, we were playing karaoke in the car for 15 hours there and back. And I have not, I just don't get the opportunity to watch as much as I would like. But man, the British Open is such a fun event to play. You go over there, it's just a different atmosphere with the galleries. And the galleries approach to watching golf, it really is night and day to playing in a U.S. Open and a British Open. But with that close of a field, anything can happen, particularly if any weather pops up. I imagine Charlie's feeling pretty good being on home soil and is getting a lot of support, so that would be really fun for her.
Absolutely. And Nelly Korda is teeing off any minute now, and she will start this final round at 4-under, tied for 9th place. Well, I know you are the defending champion of the U.S. Senior Women's Open, and that's coming up in Portland, August 24th to 27th. So how's your game?
Well, I'm going to be playing a little bit more this week. I have been playing more this summer just with the opportunities that came with winning the Senior U.S. Open last summer. I feel good about my game, you know. Now, if I can get in the right headspace to be there and have all the pieces, you know, fall into place, I think I have a pretty good chance of having a really good finish again this year. The course that we're playing is Waverly. It is a very old-style country club. When I went there for media day, I learned a lot about the history. Thank you to David Jacobson, Peter Jacobson's brother. He is quite the historian. And, you know, just side note for those golf geeks out there, Waverly is the official first site of the Green Jacket, and Augusta implemented it.
Wow.
Little tidbit of trivia for you there, Anne. So,
and covering 25 Masters. I should know that. Wow. Jill McGill. Great talking with you. Good luck in the to defend your title and, you know, continued success. And you're doing great work educating people about ovarian cancer. So important. I wish we could go on and on, but we're up against a break here. Jill McGill, thank you so much, and look forward to following your career as you continue here.
Anne, thank you very much. Have a fabulous Sunday.
Mark Canizzaro of the New York Post and fellow member of the Met Golf Writers Association board joins us now. Mark, welcome to Talking Golf.
Good morning, Ann. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. And I know you've been at Trump National this week for LIV Golf and spoke to Phil Mickelson, and he's in the middle of yet another firestorm with these Ryder Cup betting allegations. What do you make of all of it?
Yeah, you know, there's a few things to unpack there. And, I mean, obviously, as we all know, Phil's had, you know, by his own admission, a lot of gambling issues in his life. And the guy that made the allegations, obviously, is Billy Walters, is a, you know, notorious lifelong gambler, also was convicted for insider trading in a case that somewhat involved Phil because Phil had bought some of the stock that Walters was accused of the insider trading with, and Walters wanted Phil to testify on his behalf, and Phil was on the advice of his legal counsel did not, and Walters now has blamed Phil for having him been sent away for 5 years to jail, and so now he writes this book, which everybody has known for quite a while is about to come out, and it's pretty clear that he has an axe to grind with Phil, of course, and even in the excerpt that came out the Fire Pit Collective website this past week, which is what kind of precipitated Phil's reaction. This guy made it clear that he blames Phil for his downfall and his going to jail and whatnot. So, so you have to kind of, you have to take that with a grain of salt and consider the source situation here. And obviously, as I mentioned before, Phil's been pretty transparent in the last year or two about his gambling issues and how he's gone and gotten help. So, Phil has been on record in the past with my colleague Bob Harrig, who I know you've had on the show here.
Sure.
From Sports Illustrated. As saying he's never been on golf in terms of competition, like tournament golf. Obviously, he's well known for gambling in his practice rounds and whatnot, which has been kind of a fun thing over the years. But so he reiterated, Phil did this week, stating that he never been on the Ryder Cup, never went that route, and would never discredit the sport that way. So. You have to take everybody for their word and decide, on your own who you're believing, so that's kind of where it stands.
Sure.
Essentially. Yeah,
the
bottom line, and I wrote a column about this the other day, in a lot of ways, Phil's always been an adventure seeker, both on and off the golf course, as you know, so, and sometimes it's to his detriment and gets himself into trouble, and obviously, in retrospect, he should never have associated with a guy like this guy, Billy Walters, and, it's now kind of coming back and burning him a bit.
I would think. I mean, these are serious allegations, so do you think it's something that the golf powers have to look into? I mean, they can't have players betting on themselves or fans or anyone even thinking that this is happening.
I don't think it's impossible to prove because... I mean, here's the funny thing. Even Billy Walters in his book says his allegation was that Phil came to him and wanted to place bets on the Ryder, or bet on the Ryder Cup, because these two guys were in kind of an informal partnership in
sure.
gambling, according to Walters. And Walters claims in the book that he talked Phil out of it. And he said, I don't know, basically I'm paraphrasing, he said, I don't know if Phil ended up betting on the Ryder Cup or not at this point, but I did not do it with him. We did not place a bet together. It's a lot of hearsay, It's kind of,
yeah.
Listen.
But he did have exact numbers on all these other bets. I mean, I don't know how he got that research, but, saying that he's
$1 billion
and...
Yeah. My assumption is, in terms of some of the exact numbers he had, were the bets that they made together as they were,
right.
partnering up, with... And those are things that Phil has not, specifically... those are things that he hasn't denied because obviously that was all in the wheelhouse of his heavy gambling period of time in his life. And getting back to your original question, there's no way to prove it, A, and B, the tour and the powers that be in golf obviously, don't permit, their own players betting on their tournaments. Much like, baseball and football and everybody else. I mean, right now, we're also spinning into a very slippery slope in our entire sports society, aren't we? The NFL is in bed with all the sports are in bed with these betting companies. And, the NFL suspending guys for a year or half a year if they're found gambling. We're in a very, very gray area, almost
Absolutely.
Hypocritical period in the entire...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Phil had, said that he's taken full responsibility, he's gotten help, he's been fully committed to therapy that has positively impacted him, and he feels good about where he is now. So, he's always in these controversial situations, and of course now at this live event in New Jersey, he's tied for second. Anytime it seems that, you know, things are happening around him that are so negative, he focuses on his game, and this is the first time he's going to be in the final pairing, and you know, and what, since he's joined live, so he knows that this, you know, if he starts to win again, maybe people are going to just start talking about his game, which has not been the case for, what, 2 years now. So
no, it's fascinating that he's in the mix, isn't it? I mean, this week at a very, very difficult golf course, which is playing long, you know, obviously with the as wet as it's been in the area here this week. And you're right, his results at Live have been nothing to speak of at all. Obviously he's had a couple little flashes in the last year and change, and so obviously, you know, finishing the runner-up at Augusta and whatnot, but for the most part, his form has not been that great. I mean, I was actually talking to Patrick Reed the other day about Phil for a second piece that I did about Phil, just kind of about the player and fan reaction and what their view of him is, and even Patrick said, you know, I know his results, you know, his results has not been, you know, what he'd like, you know, but here we are, you know, he's just a few shots off the lead going into today's final round. And if he were to win this tournament, it would be quite some kind of story. It really would.
I mean, he's just a fascinating character. And, you know, the only time he has really spoken to the media in the last, two seasons is really during press conferences. I remember, you know, he was not happy with me last year at the U.S. Open at the Country Club in Brookline because he had been gone for a number of months following all the controversy, you know, of his words to author Alan Shipnuck, which led to Alan's, you know, book, basically, biography. But I had asked Phil at that press conference, what does legacy mean to you in light of all this live golf controversy? And, you know, he was not happy with my question, and Netflix picked it up, my question in episode 5. And although they edited his answer, I actually thought his answer was pretty decent. But, you know, for film, they just showed him looking at me like he was ready to kill me.
Yeah, that was in the belly of the beast in terms of the whole Liv controversy and him being, you know, certainly the face of Liv and
right,
taking most of the bullets. Yeah, that might have been the most uncomfortable press conference I think I've ever attended.
It was crazy.
I would put that one up there probably with the Bill Belichick stepping down from the Jets press conference,
right,
a bunch of years ago. I mean, it was a cringeworthy press conference that day.
You're absolutely right. And so what did he have to say to you? Because he hasn't really spoken to anybody outside of these kind of group press conferences.
You know, and basically, I mean, I had spoken to Phil a lot prior and leading into Liv and whatnot. And he knew that this was going to be, you know, there was going to be some rough seas, so to speak, ahead. He knew there was going to be a lot of criticism. You know, again, I don't want to take, I mean, we only have a segment here, but I mean, you know, Phil went to Jay Monahan, as a story I wrote in February of 2021, I believe it was. I had spoken to him. This is before Liv even anybody even knew what Liv was. It was still in the embryonic stage, and he had gone to Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour a commissioner, with a proposal and an investor who was ready to put $1 billion up, $500 million to start, another $500 million after that, where they were going to take about six or eight of the PGA Tour tournament weeks, where, you know, just the fields are traditionally weak, and they were going to buy out those weeks, and they were going to turn those into team events with all the top players going against each other, which is kind of what this whole golf world has been trying to find or accomplish or get that sweet spot for years. And Monahan and the PGA Tour officials on the PGA their board roundly just rejected it, because the catch was it was going to be player and investor owned, those handful of events, not PGA Tour owned. And the PGA Tour, in my opinion, arrogantly said, you know what, and in fact Ed Hurley, who's the top gun at the on the PGA Tour board, his quote to the investor was, anything that is not PGA Tour owned or operated is considered hostile. And that quote, in my opinion, set Phil off and got made him a little bit reckless because it angered him so much. Because the PGA Tour, as you know, is a not-for-profit organization.
Right.
And that kind of comment certainly belies any not-for-profit. So my point is, if the PGA Tour had gone that route, they could have cut the entire Saudi and live concept off at the knees right there, and we wouldn't even be talking about this. But the tour, you know, let's be honest, has monopolized the sport and wanted to continue to do so. And, you know, that the live money has now, as we've seen, prevented it from doing so because it's obviously the bottomless pit of Saudi money. And that's now forced the PGA Tour into this quote-unquote agreement, this framework agreement, and which we don't know where it's going to go. So,
do you think it's going to happen?
My point is quickly. Phil, kind of this. He was prophetic about this kind of stuff.
Yes, he was.
So so that's kind of where we're at right now. And all these things that he proposed are now coming to fruition. But they're coming to fruition because of Liv.
And do you think this proposed partnership, between the PGA Tour, DP World Tour, and the Saudi PIF Public Investment Fund, do you think it's actually going to happen?
I think something will happen. I do. The way I see it, in the simplest terms coming out, is we'll see a PGA Tour at some point where there will be a handful, six or so, whatever, I'm throwing a number out, of team events with those top players. So you still have a team element going in the sport. And Liv, still has obviously a seat at the table. But, yeah, I do see that. I don't see how Liv can sustain on its own the way it's going right now because it's just not the product is just not possible to be a moneymaker. And my biggest problem with the Liv concept, I have no problem with Liv, but I have the biggest problem to me as a sports fan is there's no consequence to the result, other than another $4 million in a guy's bank account. And we're all numb to the money, aren't we now?
Yeah, the money's crazy. But if an investor comes in with upwards of $1 billion, which was revealed during the Senate hearing, I find it really difficult to believe, Mark, that what will be a, quote, minority investor, as the PGA Tour commissioner has stated again and again, it's hard to believe that the PGA Tour would be in control, which they continue to reiterate, if, the Saudis come in with that much money.
That's a fair point, but the PGA Tour still is strong, and it still is the PGA Tour, and the Saudis just wanted a seat at the table. So I think that this is just me talking. I don't know, this is not coming from sources, from the live end, but I don't view this as something where the Saudis want to take over the PGA Tour and take over golf. I think they just want a piece of the action. They want a piece of the action, not just financially, but kind of, kind of to the sports washing element of it. They have a piece of the action in Formula One, and they have a lot of piece of the action in European soccer and the English Premier League. They don't own it and haven't taken the whole thing over.
Right,
I think
right.
They just want a piece, at the table and all that kind of thing. So that's
and
where
a membership
I see this.
At Augusta
exactly.
National.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That might be the hardest thing for them to get of all, right?
Anyway, well, listen, we're out of time, but it's always great to connect with you. Great seeing you in Ireland as well, and I really appreciate your insight on this. We'll do it again, hopefully, in the future.
Anytime, man. Thanks for having me on.
My thanks to Mark Canizzaro, to Jill McGill, to Bill McAdin, and to Mike Goodsell in production. As William Arthur Ward once said, a warm smile is the universal language of kindness. So keep smiling. Be safe, be kind. And I look forward to talking to you next time right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.